We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer at the controls for this hour. Jason Croft and Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this part of the program, we'll try to take a look at the long-term sustainability of some of the systems designed to support people in their retirement years. The systems that cover large numbers of Americans, like Social Security, and also systems that cover people who work in the private sector and the public sector. And our guest for the program is Jeffrey Brown. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He has been with us before to talk about pension issues. And we thought it would be a good opportunity to, since there had been so much in the news lately, to perhaps come back and to try to have get a kind of an overview of some of the important issues that have to do with pensions. And that's what we're going to try to do here this morning. Questions, as always, are welcome. If you would like to call, 333-9455. There's a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. And in addition, if you would like to write, you can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Any way here you want to do it, you're certainly welcome to participate in the conversation. And I know that Professor Brown will do his best to respond to your questions. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
The thing is that concerns about all of these systems are not exactly new. For years, people have been raising questions about the security and the soundness of Social Security. We have talked before about pension plans in the private sector and concerns about whether, in some cases, some large companies would be able to meet their commitment to their workers when they retire. And just now, recently, the issue of pensions for government workers have been in the news. And we certainly have been, for a little while here, been hearing about the issue of the problem of underfunding there. It seems that though, in a way, that this has all come together at once, which makes you wonder, do we have some kind of massive pension crisis here that's just all across the board?
Well, it's a great question. And there are a couple things that have contributed to the fact that all of these are on the agenda today. The Social Security problems have been known for a couple of decades now. The Social Security trustees have been projecting long-term shortfalls. And for many years, those shortfalls were expected to begin later this decade. There was a key date at which cash flows were going to start to go negative from Social Security, and that was usually around 2016, 2017, 2018. Well, it's already started. And the reason that we got there a little bit quicker than everyone expected was because of the economic downturn that we experienced recently. That same economic downturn has obviously substantially lessened the value of the assets held in both public and private pension plans. And so for slightly different reasons, but both tracing back to the broader economy, I think the recent economic downturn and the financial crisis just brought forward in time problems that we were sort of destined to experience anyway, in part as a result of longer-term demographic trends of the aging of the population. So as a result of the recession and equity market declines and lower tax revenue, we really are seeing sort of the convergence of problems in all of these sectors. Yeah. And it's just making it certainly bringing it to the top of the agenda.
Well, just to stay with Social Security for a second. And again, sure. This is something that has been up for discussion for a while. And I think that some people have advanced this argument that the system is in trouble and that reform was needed. Other people have said, well, that's just an excuse for those people who actually want to get rid of the system completely. But now I suppose that the thing, though, that is new is that now just this has happened within the last, I guess, couple of months. The government has said that for now, for the first time, more money is going out than is coming in. That I think, you know, gave fresh fresh energy to this debate about Social Security and its future.
Absolutely. I mean, look, there are always going to be people on both sides of these debates who are driven by ideological or political reasons. But most of the people who really seriously study the Social Security system, regardless of ideology or background, the people that, you know, the economists, the actuaries, the serious policy analysts, independent places like the Congressional Budget Office or Government Accountability Office, countless bipartisan commissions, they've all been saying for years that this day was going to come. Mm. What is in fact new, as you suggest, is the Social Security trustees just issued their most recent report about a week or two ago. And in that report, one of the major headlines is that these cash shortfalls that we're now experiencing are expected to be permanent. So we've reached this new era where for really the last quarter of a century, ever since the 1983 Social Security reforms, which were pushed through by the Greenspan Commission. Well, there was a Greenspan Commission headed by Alan Greenspan, but the real key players on that commission were folks like Senator Moynihan, Bob Dole, really key players on the Hill. And they were able to push through a reform to fix Social Security. But it didn't take very long after that for people to realize that wouldn't be permanent, that it led to a couple of decades of running surpluses in Social Security. Mm-hmm. Those surpluses were essentially, they were credited to the Social Security trust funds. We have several trillion dollars in those Social Security trust funds. But the problem is at the same time we were doing that, we were running massive deficits for most of the last 25 years in the rest of government. And so there's a real question of, okay, great, we've got this trust fund that Social Security can now start drawing upon now that we're running these deficits. But we don't really have any money there. It's a claim upon the federal treasury. And so the treasury is going to have to come up with the money to redeem those bonds, which they will do. But it means we've either got to, you know, cut spending or raise taxes or engage in other borrowing from the public in order to pull that off. Yeah.
Well, there is this expectation that government simply will have to find some way to find the money so the benefits can be paid. I think as far as state pensions are concerned, I think that there's that same expectation. In the private sector, that's really not one wonders just what the future there is, and it seems like it wasn't all that long ago there was some concern that maybe some companies that had made promises to their workers would have to say to them, well, sorry about that, but we're not going to be able to fulfill that commitment, and that in fact that the government might have to step in.
Yeah, there's actually – I think it's worth stepping back for a minute and pointing out some differences across these three sectors because they are important. And the Social Security system, from the day it was put into place in the late 1930s, this wasn't necessarily the case in the original 1935 legislation, but by the time the program was actually implemented after 1939, it was not really designed to pre-fund these benefits. It's what we call a pay-as-you-go system, so that essentially today's workers, we collect taxes from them and we turn around and we pay them out to today's retirees. So there's no attempt to sort of, you know, save that money the way that, say, a corporate plan or the way many state plans do. And that can work pretty well as long as you've got lots of workers and the economy is growing and so forth. What we're running into there is the fact that we've got more and more retirees and fewer workers to support each one. And so that was a fairly predictable problem. What's different about in private sector pension plans, the traditional defined benefit plan, which is where the employer is sort of obligated to make these future payments. Back in the 60s, there was a famous case just over the border in Indiana where a Studebaker plant shut down and people lost all of their retirement benefits. And so that led to many years of negotiation that led up to 1974 ERISA Act, Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. That basically requires that private sector plans fund their pensions. They are required by law to do so. Problem is there have been a whole bunch of essentially loopholes and accounting gimmicks and so forth that allow them to less than fully fund them on a really economic basis. And the problem there is that workers are no longer really all that at risk because we've got this Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or the PBGC, that will guarantee those benefits. But the PBGC is also underfunded. They've taken on these huge liabilities from, you know, companies like United Airlines and Bethlehem Steel, and they owe billions more than they have in assets. So ultimately, the taxpayer is probably going to be on the hook for that as well. And then, of course, the public sector is kind of somewhere in between. Most of the public sector plans try to do some funding. They're not really required to, except by their own state laws. And then, you know, here in places like Illinois, the legislature then, you know, year after year after year decides not to make the full pension obligation fund, or not to fully fund its obligations. And so we've built up over the years many billions of dollars of shortfalls. Mm-hmm. So there are some commonalities, but also I think some important differences as to how we got here in each of these cases.
Yeah. Well, so in the case of Social Security, then, just sort of to review, is that really just about simple demographics in the sense that we have fewer workers to paying into the system to support the retirees, and then people are living longer, so benefits have to be paid out over longer periods of time. You think if you, you know, plot those two things out, you can pretty much see what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Social Security, in some sense, is the easiest to understand. It's just sort of basic arithmetic. You have, you know, you're collecting about 12.4% of payroll up to a maximum of about $106,000. On everyone. And that money then goes out to pay the benefits to, you know, about close to 50 million retirees and workers who are disabled and their, you know, spouses, widows, things like that. And so it really is just a very simple case of the, you know, to support each retiree, you need to have enough workers to do it. And that ratio has fallen dramatically over the years. If you go back to 50 years ago when John Kennedy was president, we had more than five workers supporting each retiree. We're down to about three today, and that's falling quickly down to two, you know, probably by the time I retire. And if you kind of do the math, what that means is that, you know, when we go from three workers to two workers, the taxes on each of those workers has to go up by 50% in order to continue to pay the same benefits to retirees. So it is a serious problem that's just driven by demographics and the way we've designed the system. And there's really nothing sort of sinister about it. It's just a natural effect of demographics on the way we've structured the way the system is financed.
Well, there, and it seems that what needs to be done, well, people have talked about a number of things, and they seem to be pretty much straightforward. Either people are going to have to, more will have to come out of their paychecks to go into Social Security. People, we will have to continue to raise the age at which people can receive benefits. We might have to limit cost of living increases. We might have to put some sort of cap on, you know, on what you can receive, acknowledging the fact that, you know, your average person probably needs the money more than Bill Gates, for example. You know, so there's a number of things that we've talked about doing. I'm not really sure that we've actually had come to much agreement, although I guess we continue to bump up the retirement age.
Well, it's important to note that the bumping up of the retirement age was something that was voted on back in 1983 during that those reforms. And in they did what was politically a smart thing. They said, well, we're going to raise the retirement age, but we're going to start doing it many, many years from now. And then we're going to phase it in over many more years so that all the people that have to vote for this, you know, their constituents won't be affected. You know, the way I usually put it to people is, at the end of the day, there are really only two options. We either need to get more money into the system, which is we raise taxes in some form or another, or we redirect money from other government programs, or we cut the benefits coming out of the system. And we can do that either by making people wait until they're older to get those benefits, by changing the formula, by affecting cost of living, by you know, all the different ways you said it. Yeah. There are many different ways to do this, and you'll hear discussions out there about, you know, the way we index benefits and should we do progressive price indexing. They're all just different ways of essentially either cutting the outflows or increasing the inflows. And at the end of the day, we've got to do one or the other.
Well, so now that we've actually come to the point where there's more money going out than coming in, something that people have said, you know, eventually we're going to come to that point, does that add any fresh urgency to dealing with this, or are we going to continue to forgive the cliche, we continue to kick the can down the road on this?
Well, it's I think it certainly increases the urgency in terms of making people understand that the problem is real. It's not just something that's off in the future. It's here now. Having said that, I do think it's important so that, you know, anyone out there who is worried about their own Social Security benefits, you know, there's no reason to be alarmed. Because the way this works is that while there is a shortfall, and what I mean by that is that the payroll taxes that are being paid in are no longer enough to pay for the current benefits, Social Security does have a legal right to continue to pay full benefits as long as there is a positive balance in the trust fund. And we have several $1 trillion of balance in the trust fund. Now, we can have a discussion, if you want, about whether there's any sort of real economic meaning to that trust fund. But from a legal and a practical standpoint, it's quite important in that as long as we've got money in the trust fund, we'll continue to pay full benefits. And that money in the trust fund is not really expected to fall to zero for a couple more decades. So some elected officials will use that positive trust fund balance as a bit of an excuse not to act because they'll say, well, we've still got another 20 years before we really have to worry about this. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be unfortunate because the longer we wait, the steeper any tax increase or benefit cut will have to be. And one of the things that I think is very important and I think is critical to doing this in a way that is doesn't cause upheaval and doesn't cause a lot of harm to individuals is whatever we do, we've got to phase in and over time. We've got to give people an ability to adjust. So if we are going to affect benefits, you know, we shouldn't touch benefits for people that are already retired. We shouldn't touch benefits for people that are very close to retirement. But, you know, for somebody in their 40s or 30s or 20s, I think we can. And as long as they know that far enough in advance and can adjust their own savings behavior and so forth to offset it, that is a much better situation than finding ourselves, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, out of money in the trust fund, and suddenly we've just got to cut benefits by 25%. That would be a really bad outcome.
We have a couple of callers. We'll get right to them. I should introduce again our guest, Jeffrey Brown. He's professor of finance and also director of the Center for Business and Public Policy at the University of Illinois within the College of Business. And questions are welcome here. We're talking about some issues having to do with both state and federal pensions. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And also, if you want to send us an email, you can do that, will-illinois.edu. And here's some callers, starting off, excuse me, with Champaign, with Champaign County, and that's line four, free line. Hello.
Hi. I think I've argued with you before, and I'm finding this idea that there's unanimity about Social Security very outraging. Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot wrote the book, The Social Security Phony Crisis. Dean Baker just happened to be a guest of this radio station on the show Media Matters this past Sunday and didn't spend a lot of time about talking about Social Security, but I'm sure he did renew the idea that it is a phony crisis. The idea that none of the productivity gains that have accrued over the last several decades should go to Social Security, that means some kind of tax on the productivity. And, you know, what I'm saying is you don't have to just look at how many people are working. You look at how productive they are. And I don't know whether you'd probably advocate a value-added tax or something like that so that some of this productivity could be applied in the right place, but if you felt like that was a reasonable thing to do. But I don't think you do, and I just you also wanted to talk about, you know, public sector retirement, which you haven't been much late yet. But the deal there was that, you know, a lot of these people, and you're probably one of them, haven't paid into Social Security through the U of I system. And the retirement system is in lieu of that. And the idea of cutting that back, that's part of the deal. You perhaps could see your way clear to make more money in the finance capital. I don't know what to call it on the radio that's allowed to be said, enterprise. But you're not, and you are trading away some of that for perhaps a slightly better retirement system than some sectors give, particularly with the erosion of... you're getting my drift. I just wish that... I know that you've had Dean Baker on, but it's been a few years, and Mark Weisbrot would be happy to come on, I'm sure, and talk about this issue as well. But I just see this as part of the... And the reason why he was on Media Matters is because the media just does not report this fairly at all. They're quite easy solutions to Social Security, raising the cap and those sorts of things. Yeah, and the scaring around it would be ludicrous if it hasn't been so effective. And I guess I'll hang up and listen, and perhaps someone else will join in my attack on your credibility. Thank you.
Go ahead. Because this essentially, we've been having the same argument. I mean, here in the United States, we've been having the same argument for I don't know how many years now.
Let me just jump in. I mean, first of all, I don't view anything the caller said as attack on my credibility because, I mean, I actually know Dean Baker, and, you know, it's a fairly small community of people that are Social Security experts in this area. We've all interacted before. The idea of the – let me say a couple of things. The idea of the phony crisis was really a reaction to some of the more some of the elements that suggested that the only way to fix Social Security was to fundamentally change its entire structure and privatize it and so forth. Okay, I don't disagree that you don't have to do that. If what you want to do is just fix the existing system, you can. But let's be clear that the cash flow issue is a real one. That's just simple dollars and cents flowing back and forth. That's just simple arithmetic. Your idea that you can capture some of the productivity gains is true. The question is, how do you do that? And I think you said it yourself. You do that by raising taxes. It's important to note that the way productivity folds into Social Security is productivity gains lead to higher wages. Higher wages lead to more payroll taxes into the system. It also leads under the current system to higher future benefits because benefits are themselves a function of wages. So while it is true that if we could have more rapid productivity growth, that helps postpone some of the cash flow problems. It makes them less severe. It does not eliminate them. And the only way that within the existing structure of the existing pay-as-you-go system, if you don't want to touch benefits, the only way you can capture more of the productivity gains for the system is to raise taxes. Now, you could do that by raising the cap, although, you know, even if you eliminate the cap, it doesn't eliminate the whole problem. You could raise rates. You could do that sort of thing. And that is an intellectually defensible and perfectly legitimate position. Many of us have concerns about how high we want marginal tax rates to go because, you know, in addition to Social Security, we got to think about the fact that Medicare is an even bigger problem. We have to think about the fact that our current revenue stream, even setting Social Security and Medicare aside, is woefully inadequate to cover our existing non-entitlement expenditures. We're running very large federal deficits right now. And so, you know, we may need taxes there too. So you can't just raise taxes across the board without there being a negative impact on economic growth, which will then hurt your future productivity gains. So there's not really a simple answer here. And so, again, I don't view what the caller said as attacking my credibility at all. I think that there's a recognition that there's a problem. I think Dean Baker understands that there's a problem. He's a smart guy. He has a PhD. He understands that you can't run a system where the costs outweigh the revenue over time. We just have perhaps different views on the desirability of using taxes as opposed to benefit cuts to address it.
Just one more thing, and we've got some other callers here. I think, again, that this notion that there was a crisis and something really dramatic had to be done about it doesn't indeed go back some years and hooks up with the idea that some people had that as you say, that what they really wanted to do was get rid of the system as it existed, and had this vision for something to replace Social Security that would be essentially like a 401k. That people would be making decisions about where that money would go, and that would probably go into the stock market. And they were talking about building a completely different sort of a system. Does anybody really make that trying to advance that argument anymore?
Well, I mean, I think, and as you know, I was involved in the debates back in 2005 when President Bush tried to push a partial sort of a mix system. Yeah. And I think one of the aspect of that that is politically just no longer that viable is taking any of the revenue from the existing system and redirecting it into those accounts. I think where there could be room for some compromise from both sides is that the Republicans are not real excited about putting additional tax revenues into the existing system for a whole variety of reasons. The Democrats, of course, don't want to see benefits reduced, but there's a role in there for thinking, well, let's suppose that we do want to put new revenue into Social Security rather than doing it just to sort of continue to prop up the existing pay-as-you-go system. What if the new revenue went into accounts and that then the balance of those accounts could provide future benefits, and those future benefits could then offset some of what people would have gotten from Social Security? So, you know, there are things like that that might still be on the radar screen, but I don't think we're going to get something like that in the next few years. I certainly don't think that's a place that the current administration would want to go. Although I will tell you, the current administration has a lot of people in it that fully understand the fact that Social Security is not sustainable in its current form, and they've chosen not to make it an issue in their first term. But I think they're going to have to deal with it in the second term if he were reelected.
All right. On to some other callers here. Urbana next. Line one. Hello.
Yes. A couple of premises. One is that you could increase the initial age for retirement benefits because lifespan has increased. Well, that isn't entirely true. Lifespan has increased, but much more for upper income groups than for the lower income group. And actually, industrial workers probably only live a year or two more now than they did when it was introduced, which is an embarrassment to, I think, the country. So increasing the retirement age would not be exactly fair. Another premise that was advanced was that increased productivity, which has been great over the last 40 years or so, has been fairly distributed, and that wages have gone up. But this isn't true. Real wages have actually declined for probably 80% of the citizenry. So there's a problem with adjustment. We have the most disproportional distribution of wealth of any of the advanced nations. You'd have to go to some second, third world country to find this kind of extreme disproportionality of income distribution. If you increase the ceiling on Social Security deductions, then you will at least partially counterbalance this. And that would be a benefit to the country as a whole.
Well, okay, we'll get some you want to comment
on that?
There
are a great deal more, I don't want to take more time. Thank you.
The caller raises some very good points. First, with regard to longevity, it is in fact true that longevity increases have not been proportionate across the population. We know that not only do higher income individuals live longer, but the rate at which they are experiencing mortality declines is greater than that of lower income individuals. And that is one of the complications that people run into when they're talking about how to address the system. Look, at the end of the day, we know a couple of very simple facts. We know that right now there is less money coming into the system than is required to pay the benefits that we've promised people. Second, that problem is going to get worse rather than better over time. In particular, the next 25 years is a particularly important time in regard to those trends because of the baby boomers moving into retirement. And so that gap is going to grow wider and wider to the point where in today's dollars, it's going to be several hundred billion dollars a year. At the end of the day, someone has to pay for this in some way or another. Either people have to pay more in taxes or people have to get less in benefits. And you know what? Reasonable people can disagree over what the right mix of that is and who should pay more and who should pay less. But let's just be clear, there aren't any easy answers and there are not any pain-free answers. So yes, it's true that productivity growth has not been fully distributed across the population. And, you know, I'm not going to get into a debate about which part of the wage distribution and how our measurement of inflation affects that and so forth. But it is true that productivity growth has not been equally distributed. And if you think that the answer to that is tax the rich, you know, you can do that. But I will tell you, you can't do it without there being real economic costs, just as there are real economic costs to any other policy we provide. There's no free lunch here. And it doesn't matter. You know, you may think from a fairness standpoint that we should just sock it to the rich and to the corporations and what have you. And if that's your view, fine. But at least understand what it is that you're doing. And let's not pretend that there's not a problem that needs to be addressed. And I think where, you know, when you get people in a room that really understand the nature of the problem, there will still be important disagreements over how much of this should be done on the tax side versus the benefit side, and should we raise the cap or should we, you know, things of those nature. Those are legitimate policy disagreements. My role here today is just to point out I'm not here to propose or to support any one policy over another. It's just to make the point that we face serious problems and we need to address them. And much of our political leadership appears unwilling to. And when people do take positions, they are immediately attacked as, you know, trying to throw grandma over the cliff. And I just think that's unfortunate. So, you know, the caller has his own view about how he would address it. I have my views. I'm sure we probably wouldn't disagree. I mean, that we probably wouldn't agree on how to do it. But I'm happy to hear that he at least recognizes the problem and has one plan to address it. Mm.
Jeff Brown is our guest this morning. He's a professor of finance at University of Illinois. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the new science of dog behavior. Some trainers say, don't let your dog win at tug of war, you'll appear submissive. Not true, says John Bradshaw.
If you do let a dog win over and over again at tug of war, it likes you. It wants to play with you more than it did to begin with because it's having fun.
Bradshaw's new book is Dog Sense. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We're here weekend mornings with 10 different topics. Tomorrow, we have some archives for you in the first hour. We'll repeat a show from March, a conversation I had with journalist Doug Saunders about his book, Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. It's about a phenomenon that we see around the world, a lot of places, with lots of people moving from the country to the city. And about what that means. That's the first hour tomorrow. Then in the second hour, we'll have some more of our special 30th anniversary archives. We're calling this project the Deep Archives because we've been digging into a tape collection that we have, some of our oldest shows. This program, Focus, has been on the air now 30 years, and we have some what I think are interesting interviews that have not been heard in a very long time. They're not part of our regular web archive. So we're bringing some of those back. We'll have some more tomorrow. If you'd like to find out what we're doing on the show, go to our website. You can also listen to past programs there. It's at will.illinois.edu. And the guest in this hour of Focus is Jeff Brown. He's professor of finance at the U of I, director of the Center for Business and Public Policy. We're talking about pension issues. I wanted to maybe at least talk for a bit here about something else. An earlier caller said we really hadn't gotten to the public sector issues, and we hadn't. That's been much in the news lately. One thing you said it might be interesting to talk about is the funding issue or the underfunding issue, since that's where a lot of the attention has been focused. Here in the state of Illinois, we're told we have the most underfunded pension system in the entire country. Maybe California is not all that far behind, and there are some other states that have serious problems too. But the question is how it is we look at that, and is it really that bad? Is it as bad as that makes it sound?
Well, there's a couple different ways to look at it, and in some ways, it's actually worse than it sounds. Let me make a couple of points on the Illinois pension system. The first is Illinois, I think, has the single worst record of any state that I am aware of in terms of making good on its annual funding obligations. They're basically, for all intents and purposes, in the last three decades, there has not been a single year where they've made the required contribution, with the exception of a year in which Governor Blagojevich issued a bunch of pension obligation bonds, which doesn't really solve the problem. It puts money into the pension plan, but now the taxpayers owe that money still. The point is, we've been living beyond our means in the state of Illinois for many decades. We've used the pensions as a way of borrowing money by not making good on our obligations. And so that's coming home to roost. The reason that I say the problem can actually be worse than it seems is we know that, you know, take like the state university retirement system that a lot of the listeners are participants in. It has a funding ratio right now of somewhere around 42 or 43%. And what that means is that, you know, if you took the money that's in there today and you invest it going forward, you'd only have enough money to make good on about 43% of the benefits. A lot of economists don't like the way the Government Accounting Standards Board allows them to do those calculations, because they implicitly they're ignoring the risk of the investment portfolio. So we actually think the funding situation is worse than that. Now, on the other hand, what it means is, you know, in some ways it's in better shape than Social Security, and that Social Security is not really doing any funding at all. At least we have 40% funded. So it's not like CSRS or the state teacher system is going to run out of money tomorrow. It simply means that generations have not paid the full cost of the public services that they've gotten from public sector workers in the past. That's clearly not the fault of the workers, right? I mean, they've made their contributions. In some ways, it's not really the fault of current taxpayers either, because many of them didn't live in this state 20, 30 years ago, back when the politicians were not making good on these promises. So we're in this unfortunate situation where we've got this enormous debt essentially built up. We owe workers benefits, and at least the benefits that they've earned up until today, I think it's pretty clear that at least those benefits are constitutionally protected and are going to need to be paid. The question is, who's going to pay that? How are we going to pay it? And so we're having a very difficult debate now about how to do that. And I will say that no matter what we do going forward, I think University of Illinois President Hogan is down in Springfield today. There's hearings going on about changing the CSRS system. No matter what we do going forward, we've still got many billions of dollars of money that we owe for benefits that have already been earned that we don't have the money there, and we're going to have to come up with that money. Now, going forward, I think there's a legitimate debate about what the nature of our overall compensation package ought to look like, and how much of that should be in the form of pensions and how much of that should be in the form of salary, taking into account the fact that, you know, public workers like myself do have other opportunities. And if you just try to slash pensions without making up for it in some other way, some of our best people might leave and go elsewhere. So again, these are very tricky issues. But it, again, it's not that we're going to run out of money tomorrow. I don't think anyone should be making a decision of, oh, should I hurry up and retire today out of fear that the money's going to somehow disappear. I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, I cannot imagine that benefits are going to be – that there's any way that benefits that you've earned already can be touched. I think the debate going forward is going to be about future benefit accruals for existing employees.
Well, just real quick – and I have the callers. Just real quick, though, that when you look at the kinds of reforms that are being discussed – as you say, these are things that the big changes will be for people, not perhaps so much for people who are working now, say, for the state of Illinois, for the University of Illinois, but for the people who will be starting.
Well, yes and no. So as of January 1st of this year, we've already made changes for new employees that are coming in. Yeah. Okay. But let's take existing employees, and here's the distinction. I think any money that people – any benefits that people have earned through what they have done up until today, those benefits are secure. I can't imagine any court being able to interpret the impairment clause of the Constitution any other way. Mm-hmm. But those existing employees, some of them are still – 5, 10, 20, 30 years away from retirement, and they've still got future benefits that they can earn. And I think there's a legitimate legal question, as well as a political question and an economic question, of whether or not we can change the benefit formula that is in place for those future years of work. And that's a big important thing, because if we can't do that, then the state's just going to have to come up with a lot of revenue. If we can do that, then a lot of public employees are going to see their future pensions be changed. And what's being debated right now today in Springfield is a legislative proposal that would change future benefits for current workers. And that's the big debate that we're going to have. And my guess is if they do pass this, of course, then it would have to go to the Senate and it'd have to be signed by the governor, and none of that may happen. But if it did, there are surely going to be lawsuits filed that will claim that this violates the impairment clause of the Constitution, and then the courts will have to make a ruling, and they will have to decide whether current employees, whether that labor contract and whether that impairment clause applies to all future benefits from the, you know, or if it only applies to the benefits they've earned.
And that's basically you're referring to that clause in the Constitution that says the benefit will be paid.
Exactly. Yeah. The benefit cannot be impaired.
Do you think, though, given enough time that the defined benefit pension for state workers is going to go away?
Well, it's it would be premature to say that. Even for new workers that have come into the system after January 1st of this year, and I'm talking about the state university retirement system, the benefit parameters have gotten a lot less generous. So it's a much older retirement age. There are a whole bunch of provisions that add up to it being less generous. The problem is, and I think the politicians in Springfield understand this, it's actually very hard to end a defined benefit plan, even if you want to, if you haven't been funding it. The reason is that you're actually somewhat reliant on the premiums that are being paid into that defined benefit plan to continue to make the payments to the current people, in the same way that Social Security is, right? Because if we had fully funded the defined benefit plan in the past, it would actually in some ways be easier to shut it down. Mm-hmm. The fact that we've got an underfunded plan means that we're on the hook to pay those benefits, and the state needs, you know, the pension funds need money in order to do that. If you somehow just ended it today, then the state's got to come up with that money even sooner than they would otherwise. So I don't really think the defined benefit plan is going to go away, and I don't think it should. But I do think that we ought to have a real discussion about, you know, maybe we reduce the defined benefit plan and then supplement it with a defined contribution plan like some counties in California have done.
Okay. We have some callers here. We'll try to get as many as we can. The first in line is Champagne Line 3. Hello.
Hi, gentlemen. I got three small points. One is I'm extremely disappointed in our local state representatives who have voted for pension holidays, as the term is used, for the state pension funds. And in this community, the impact that's going to have on state university retirement system employees or state employee retirement system people, it just boggles my mind that they can vote against that and then continue to hold office. I would hope that these people would recognize that they put these pensions in jeopardy and would vote them out of office. Secondly, if in fact you can change the benefit of an existing employee to a lesser benefit, and that passed constitutional muster, why can't they just say, okay, instead of basing your pension on your last 4 years' average salary, we're going to do it only taking 15% over the last 10 years of your salary. I mean, almost virtually take you to zero. I mean, what's the limit? Where does it stop? To prevent that from happening. If that constitutional provision doesn't stand for the fact that you can't change my benefit if I'm working for you and I've earned this benefit, what makes you think you can change it for the next 10 years that I work for you? I've already earned it by having contributed a percentage of my payroll into the system. And then the final point I wanted to make is if we've just gone through an era where banks are too big to fail, and the federal government comes in and loans them trillions of dollars at about 0%. Why can't the federal government loan the state of Illinois the billions that it truly needs to get fully funded at about 0%?
We're really short on time. I want to let the first comment stand, but I am interested in what you think, particularly about the second one. In a sense, that's still an open question.
Yeah.
How much what sort of changes in the benefits
so
could be made?
Without getting into too much details about how actuarial calculations are done, it is possible at any given point in time to basically say, look, we can calculate how much an individual has accrued in their benefits to date. It is a little complex in that it does depend on final average salary, which is a projection of the future and so forth. But there are ways of calculating what that would be and essentially protecting that and then just changing any additional accruals going forward. This kind of thing happens all the time in the private sector. So it's not an unusual calculation to do. I am quite confident that the caller's concern that there would be a way to game that to essentially take away everything would be a clear violation of the Constitution. However, there's a lot of nuance there in how those calculations have done that the courts would have to sort out and provide some guidance on. So they're not going to take it all away, but they could very much change things going forward.
And any hope that the U.S. government would help a state like Illinois with its pension problems?
Well, I know I've gotten calls from staffers on the Hill to, you know, talk about this very issue. They're starting to think about it. You know, there's a lot of reluctance to do so. If for no other reason, I can tell you that if you look at the states that are in the worst funding situation, they don't have enough. And you just look at the delegations from those states, they do not have enough votes. You would have to have states that have actually done what they were supposed to do, states that have fully funded their pension. You'd have to get their reps and their senators to agree to bail out places like California and Illinois. I don't see that happening.
All right. To next caller here, and that would be Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, just got a couple actually quick questions. I don't know if you touched this early on in the show, but when you talk about the Social Security cap on the tax, I think it should be made clear that people only pay Social Security tax up to, a little over $100,000 of income. So, you know, folks like Rush Limbaugh are done paying Social Security tax after his first paycheck, while the rest of us have to pay Social Security tax for all our lives. Secondly, if you could just address, if you know by any chance, if the prepaid tuition plan in Illinois is in the same problem of the pensions, I'm starting to hear that. And lastly, you always talk about, you know, someone has to bear the costs. Who do you think should bear the costs? I mean, we've had tax cuts for the rich, going back, you know, since Reagan, and we see the effects of that now. Are we going to tax the middle class more to pay this? Are we going to lower our living standards for our future retirees? Who do you think should bear the cost
And we only have about a minute or two left.
Well, I can be really brief. Yes, Social Security taxes only go to $106,800. People on earnings above that, you do not pay tax, but neither do you get benefits on that level. And that is one of the things that is under discussion as part of, you know, many compromise packages, is perhaps raising that cap. The prepaid tuition plan in Illinois is in a very similar situation. Fred Gertz at the U of I has written on this very fact. In fact, Fred Gertz had predicted this. He pulled out a piece he wrote about 15 years ago when they set it up, showing that this is exactly what was going to happen because they were making overly aggressive rate of return assumptions and not properly accounting for risk. With all due respect, I don't know that my particular views on who should bear the cost matter. I'm not an elected official. In general, I'm a big fan of shared burdens. I can tell you, when we have, you know, more than half of the people in this country are not paying any income tax, I think that is problematic, just as I think it's problematic that there are people that make enormous sums of money that aren't paying as much as many people would like. I think we need to approach it from a very balanced perspective, and that we need to do it from looking at benefits as well as looking at revenue.
We're pretty much at the point where we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of callers we can't take. We took on a lot here, and maybe what we need to do is try to continue to talk about these issues and take them in slightly smaller bites. But we wanted to try to do at least a little bit of an overview, and I'm sure that we will get back to these things. Just real quick, do you think we're going to be seeing more and more municipalities essentially having the same problem that we see states having?
Oh, yeah, without question. And there is an opportunity in that, if I have just 15 more seconds, the opportunity is that at the municipal level, there seems to be more experimentation and more innovation in terms of how to deal with this. And for people who are interested, you know, I think what they did out in Orange County was pretty interesting. They took Orange County is a very conservative district, but they have very powerful labor unions, and they all came together. They actually agreed on a reform proposal that did not eliminate the DB plan, but it did reduce the generosity of the parameters. But then they supplemented it with a defined contribution plan through TIAA-CREF, which I should disclose. I'm a trustee of TIAA. But it's a defined contribution plan that was very much focused on secure retirement income rather than just as an investment device. And all sides really came together on it. And I think that kind of thing can actually serve as a model for other places. And I'm sure other municipalities will come up with other ideas as well.
All right. There, we'll have to leave it. Jeff Brown is professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Thank you very much.
Thank you.